We are looking at the life of Peter, particularly with the interest of preparing us for the letters of Peter. Peter wrote two letters to the church at large towards the very end of his life. But Peter is such an interesting character, and the substance of what he writes is so profound that it's important for us to consider the man behind the words, the man behind the message, to consider his own experiences with Jesus and how those experiences shaped him and formed him and gave him the perspective behind what he writes, the exhortation that he gives to you and I. Peter in 1 Peter particularly writes to a church facing a very growing, very real persecution. Nero had gone crazy and had blamed the Christians. And there was a widespread persecution, trial, and tribulation. And Peter is writing to a church that isn't in a comfort zone, but is in the throes of trial. And to kind of understand Peter's perspective and the way in which he kind of is no-nonsense about it, you have to look at some of the seminal moments in his life that shaped his perspective. Whether you call it a trial, tribulation, persecution, it's interesting that within linguistics, within literature, analogies are used that are relevant, relatable. Difficult seasons in our life, in a very personal and practical way, we often refer to as storms. We face storms. It's been said that everyone has a storm in their life to some regard. You're either leaving a storm, you're in a storm, or you're approaching a storm. But everyone deals with storms of life. Peter dealt with storms. And it was his experiences within storms that shaped his perspective on Jesus, his perspective on ministry, his perspective on discipleship, shaped his perspective on what it meant to be a follower of Jesus. For following Jesus, yes, there can be good times, but there can also be storms. When we talk about the life of Peter, even if you had very elementary understanding of the man, it's likely, if I were to have you list things you know, at the top of that list would likely be Peter walking on water. It's a famous story about Peter's life. So famous, so significant. I mean, Peter does have claim to being the only non-God human to walk on water. Yes, Jesus walked on water, but Peter was not Jesus. And yet we're told, the scriptures tell us, that he gets out of a boat in the middle of a storm and he walks on water by the commandments of Jesus. I mean, Peter has that claim. It's in his profile. It's on his resume. If I were to ask you important moments in Peter's life, that's going to probably top your list. Everyone knows about Peter walking on water. And yet, while we'll look at that story, it's very rarely mentioned that situation was the second storm that Peter faced on the Sea of Galilee. It wasn't the first, it was the second. Now keep in mind that Peter grew up, as we've noted, in Bethsaida, there Capernaum. He grew up on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. More than likely, Peter's father had fished these waters. Peter himself had done so. Probably from a very young age, Peter had spent likely more time on the water than he did on land. Their very livelihood depended upon his occupation as a fisherman. He's in business with Zebedee and Zebedee's sons, James and John. Peter's little brother joins the business, Andrew. Peter grew up fishing, boating, living on the Sea of Galilee. And he understood the way that it worked. You see, the Sea of Galilee is it's an interesting body of water. And what makes it interesting is its particular locale. The body of water at the lowest elevation on Earth is what's known as the Dead Sea. The second body of water at lowest elevation is actually the Sea of Galilee. A lot of people don't recognize that. The Sea of Galilee sits roughly 600 feet or so below sea level. It's fed by tributaries that make up the Jordan River. From the Sea of Galilee flows the Jordan River down to the Dead Sea, in which there is no outlet, which is why it's called dead, because of its salt content. Not only is the Sea of Galilee positioned at a very low elevation, but then you couple the fact that the topography around the sea is high elevation. This is a body of water at a low point surrounded by mountain ranges. And as such, the Sea of Galilee is susceptible to wild changes of weather. It's called the Sea of Galilee, the region known as Galilee. It's called the Sea. It's an odd title because it's really a lake. When you go there, you visit Capernaum, you stand on the shore, you're really taken back a little bit by how small the Sea of Galilee is. It's roughly 7 miles by 14 miles, shaped as a harp, which is why the Greeks called it Gennesaret, the Lake of Gennesaret. They call it a sea while it's a lake because it's the lake that behaves very much like a sea. I've never seen this for myself, but you can Google photos of Jews surfing on the Sea of Galilee. You see, the higher elevation, because Galilee's low and it's warm, but it's surrounded by mountains that are typically snow-capped. Changes of weather, cold air, can rush down in a split second, mix, co-mingle with the warm air, and the pressurization churns up massive storms. The Sea of Galilee can be calm, and within 30 minutes is roaring. Now, none of this is a surprise to Peter, or Andrew, or James, or John. It's not even a surprise to Matthew, who lived in Capernaum. Anyone related to this body of water, you could feel the change in the pressure. You knew how the storms would kick up. Peter is an expert, particularly an expert when it comes to how this body of water functioned. Now, the first story we'll look at, we find recorded for us in Mark chapter 4. Beginning with verse 35, and this is early in Jesus' ministry, we read that on the same day, Jesus has been teaching the people, he's been sharing these parables. When evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go over to the other side," speaking of the Sea of Galilee. You could walk around, it's quicker to go across. It's nighttime, not a lot of traffic, it's a good time to take a good row. Now, when they had left the multitude, they took Jesus along in the boat as he was. There were other little boats also with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling. First note that the storm occurs under the authority and the directive of Jesus. Jesus is not caught off guard by the storm. He sends them into a storm knowing the storm was on the horizon. Please note that whoever creates the storm has authority over the storm and can cause the storm to cease. Jesus is in control of every facet of storms, situations in your lives. He's sovereign, he's authoritative, he's in control. Nothing happens in your life apart from God's intervention, God's directive, God's authority. Now, that doesn't negate free will and sinful decisions and consequences. And hey, there's all kinds of storms within Scripture we find. There are storms of correction. Jonah, perfect example of that. God says, go to Nineveh. Jonah says, nope, getting on a boat, going the opposite direction. God's like, okay, free will, my sovereignty, there's a storm. And Jonah knows that this is a storm to try to correct Jonah and his wayward ways to go back to the place that God wanted him. To the point that Jonah's stubborn enough that he's like, throw me in, throw me overboard. I'm not going. God had a backup plan for that. It was a great fish that swallowed him. And Jonah wasn't a man you could keep down. So he gets spat up on the shore the opposite direction. Storms of correction. When we're doing the wrong thing, and God allows consequences. Maybe there are warnings. Maybe there are stop signs that God throws up along your path. There are times where we're doing what is wrong, and we know it intrinsically, intuitively. And as a result, God will allow a storm not to destroy us, but to correct us, to get us back to the place that he wants us. There are corrective storms. There's also storms of perfection, storms that are intended by God to teach us particular lessons. I think that there's a third category of storms, just pure storms of glorification. Storms where they didn't come to correct you, and they're not there to necessarily teach you or in some ways perfect you, but you're just placed with your back against the wall so that God can be glorified in the process. I think of the storm of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. If you told those boys the day before, hey, would you like to encounter Jesus in a way you've never encountered him before? Like personally? Mano a mano? Yeah, that'd be awesome. I mean, that'd be wonderful. Okay, well, this is how it's going to work. Nebuchadnezzar is going to require everyone to bow down and worship this idol. You don't, but there's a consequence. You'll be thrown into a fiery furnace. But that's when you're going to encounter Jesus. Now, if I'm Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I'm like, encountering Jesus sounds great. Fiery furnace as the process of that, not so excited about. Lazarus, best friends with Jesus. Jesus comes to Laz like, hey, got this plan. It's unfolding. I need somebody to do something important. I got it, Jesus. I got you. I got you, bro. All right, you're going to get sick. Okay, well, that's a bummer. You're going to get real sick. That's good, but you'll show up, right, Jesus? Well, kind of. I'm going to wait till you're dead. Really dead. I'm going to like wait 4 days. Well, that doesn't sound all that. But your sisters will be ticked off. But I'm going to show up. I'll weep a little. And I'm going to call you forth. So wait, you're telling me that I have to get sick, real sick, and die, and then I get 4 days in glory. And then you're going to call me back. Can you imagine Lazarus up in heaven hanging out with Moses and Elijah and over the loudspeakers like, Lazarus, come forth. No, I've already dealt with death once. You see, Lazarus has the great opportunity to die twice. Well, this will be great. So you'll call me forth, Jesus, and I'll be famous. Well, yeah, but they're going to want to kill you. What? Is God trying to teach something specific to Lazarus? No, God's just using him to demonstrate his own power. Why was the man born blind? Well, it's so I could heal him right now. That's great for everybody but the blind guy. That's a tough road for him. I've been blind my whole life for this moment so that you could be glorified. Storms of perfection, storms of correction. Sometimes there's just storms of glorification. These men are in the midst of what we're told is a windstorm. It's a tempest. It's daunting. The weather has shifted. What started as a beautiful night, the clouds roll in. Things get dark. You're on a body of water and you can't see the moon and you can't see the stars. It's dark, pitch dark. It's not like you have a lantern that's any good. It's raining vertically and the wind's whipping and the waves are crashing over. Now these men, they've been in storms before. They've lowered the mast. The wind's contrary. They're rowing. They're professional fishermen. And yet something begins to happen that even a professional fisherman or a non-professional would understand isn't good when you're in a boat. See, the way that a boat works is that the water is outside of the boat and isn't in the boat. Like that's kind of a fundamental point of boating. Water outside, dry inside. And yet what's happening within our text, the boat, the water isn't cooperating because the water's like, we're wanting to get in the boat. And so the boat, we're told, is filling with water. That's not a good situation if you're in a storm and you're rowing. The boat gets heavier. It's going to sink. I mean, they are in a bad situation. Verse 38, and where do we find Jesus? But Jesus was in the stern, asleep on a pillow. So in the whole course of this, Jesus is sawing logs. He's sleeping. They're in a storm, and Jesus is asleep. Now it's true, Jesus is a carpenter. They're fishermen. At the beginning of the night, seemed rational. We can take this one from here, Jesus. You go catch some Z's, get some rest. Jesus obliges. He's sound asleep. Now, at some point, as you're rowing and the guy's snoring, you're thinking like, is he going to help? Like, we could at least have somebody, he might not know what he's doing, but he can take a bucket and start throwing water out of the boat that's filling. Jesus is just sound asleep. He's sleeping through the whole ordeal. Like, at what point do they decide to get his attention? At what point do they decide, do they draw, who's going to wake up Jesus to inform him, we have a problem? These men are soaking wet, cold, tired, blisters and blood. Jesus is asleep. And they woke him, and they said to him, Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? You know, it's hard to rag on these guys too much, because have you ever been guilty of making a similar accusation to Jesus in the midst of a storm, in the midst of a financial crisis or a rough patch within your marriage, or the neighbor that's just on your last nerve? Have you found yourself in a spot and you are exhausted. You know you haven't done anything wrong. This isn't consequences of your decisions. You're right in the middle of God's will. He said, get in the boat and go, and you're there, and the waves are pounding you. Life is just working you over. And you pray, and you pray, and you read, and you long, and you go to church, and you're just like, Jesus, where are you? Do you not care? You see, Jesus wasn't doing anything, and they took his inaction, and they equated to it that he didn't care. He didn't care about them. He didn't care that, first, Jesus is also in the same boat that is filling with water. I think he cares about the boat sinking. Keep in mind, Jesus has not walked on water yet. They didn't know that was in his toolbox. They come, why don't you care? You know, sometimes life is really about our, it's about perspective. I could list out several letters, and the meaning of these letters would be completely dependent upon where you put a space. I could list out N-O-W-H-E-R-E. And your perspective in the storm could be, Jesus is nowhere to be found. But if you put the space between the W and the H, we go from he's nowhere to be found to Jesus is now here. Same set of letters. Just depends on where you put the space. It depends on perspective. They looked at Jesus and they're like, you're not doing anything. But Jesus was very much in control of everything, wasn't he? And if there's a way to illustrate it, so they're crying out, do you not care that we are perishing? Then he arose and rebuked the wind and the sea. Peace be still. The wind ceased. There was great calm. And then he says to them, why are you so fearful? I love this. Like, check the flow out. Jesus is sound asleep. I think Jesus is a heavy sleeper. Wind is not waking him. The rain is not waking him. The crack of lightning, the thunder, none of this is waking him. He is out cold. But what does wake him? The cries of his disciples. And they're crying out, we're perishing. Why aren't you doing anything? And Jesus is groggy. I can see him like trying to get the sleep out. There's a little disorientation. You know, when you're sleeping as a parent and a kid comes running in, I mean, it's a crisis and they're running at 100 miles an hour and you feel like you're in a tornado. Like, I don't even know what's happening. Like, I can't, my brain's not working yet. Let me get a cup of coffee, please. Jesus, before he addresses the guys in front of him, what does he do first? He rebukes the wind. He says, be calm, peace, be calm. It's like, I can't hear these guys because of all this other noise. So he's like, shut up. Now, what are you guys afraid of? Well, there was a storm. And there were waves and there was wind. And, you know, they're standing there drenched. He's like, why are you guys so wet? Have you been swimming? And then what does he say? He says, why are you so fearful? At this point, they're thinking the same thing. Why were we afraid? And then he speaks to their faith. They feared exceedingly. They said to one another, who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him? This is storm one, which is important. Peter has lived through this first storm. Now, what's not an encouraging part of the Bible study is that you think, well, okay, I dealt with one storm. I'm done. I'm good. But there's a second storm. And then Peter would experience a third storm and a fourth storm. Like, it's not like you have one storm in your life you have to endure. And then good lessons learned. Stamp that. No, not at all. If you flip to Matthew chapter 14. A lot of things happening on this day. Jesus had received word, first thing, that his cousin, John, had been beheaded, had been executed. This is his family. And he wants to get away. He wants to spend some time with his heavenly Father. He wants to grieve. But the multitudes come out. He goes out into a deserted place, and the multitudes come out. Not just a few people, thousands of people. 5,000 men, better way of thinking about 5,000 households. The men were counted, but you had their wives, you had children. This is quite a group of people that have come out in the middle of nowhere to listen to Jesus, to be ministered to by Jesus. He wants to get alone, and he can't. And there's this amazing miracle that happens where it gets to the evening. The disciples come like, hey, you should send them away. Go into the towns to find food. Jesus is like, well, you feed them. And they're like, well, we've got 5 loaves and 2 fish. They didn't even have. They stole the Lunchable from a kid. And Jesus does this amazing miracle where he takes their little, but in the hands of the master, he feeds the multitude. To the point that there was 12 baskets of leftovers for the 12 apostles. Now, this is such a scene. Imagine being there. That we're told in John's gospel that the crowd that had gathered are wanting to make Jesus their king, even if by force, right then and there. Which would have been a major interruption to Jesus' ministry. Because if they had been successful in that particular attempt, well, then word would have gotten to the religious leaders, which would have gotten to Rome, that there's this guy in Galilee, the people are now calling him king, they're wanting a revolution, and now the whole picture of the cross and everything Jesus had come to do gets skewed. Dicey moment. So verse 22 of Matthew 14, we're told immediately, and that word denotes urgency. Jesus knows what's going on. There's a lot of people. He also knows that his apostles, these 12 men, are very much on board with making Jesus king. He knows what they're thinking about the Messiah, about the Christ, about what he had come to do. So immediately there's an urgency. Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he sent the multitude away. This word made is literally forced them. They're reluctant. Jesus is like, I need you guys to get in the boat, go to the other side. I'll meet you there. And they're like, no, well, we're not missing out on what's going on. He's like, no, you guys are going now. I'm not sure. He forces them into the boat, kicking and screaming, takes the rope off the dock and pushes it out, you know? And then he dismisses the multitude, which had to have been a miraculous thing. Jesus does this by himself. And when he had sent the multitudes away, Jesus went up on a mountain by himself to pray. Now, when evening came, he was alone there, but the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. So once again, Jesus puts them in a boat, says, go to the other side, and he says that he would meet them. Like the plan, you guys go, I'll catch up. So these men, reluctantly, they don't want to go. But they're making their way across. Jesus goes up on a mountain. More than likely, it was Mount Arbel, but we can't say for certain. But he can see them. Because again, you can see it all. And Jesus sees the storm rolling. These men are in the middle of the sea. The boat's in the middle, and it's tossed by the waves. The wind was contrary. Now, I have to give the disciples some credit here. So they lower the mast, lower the sails. Sails are not going to do any good in a contrary wind. So they pull out the oars, their backs against the direction they're going, and they're rowing. Now, in the middle of this storm, a storm kicks up. Like, even at the middle part, which is where they are, they're halfway across. Even at this point, with a contrary wind and reluctant disciples to begin with, it's amazing they didn't what? Turn around and go back. They've been real quick to get back. The wind is against them. Turn around, the wind is with them. Hoist the sail, they're back in a matter of minutes. And yet these men, Jesus said go, they are rowing, and they're going nowhere. They are stuck. And it's another storm. And the wind is whipping, and the rain is falling, and the thunder is cracking. They're in a tough spot. And unlike the first storm, there's a little detail that would be alarming. Jesus isn't in the boat. Like storm one, at least Jesus is in the boat, so he has a vested interest in making sure the ship doesn't go down. But he decided, hey, you know what? You guys go across. I'm going to stay here. Is this a setup? Is he wanting to replace us? He decided not to get in the boat. So here they are. Now, in the fourth watch, so it is somewhere between 3 and 6 a.m. It is before the break of dawn, so it is dark. They've been rowing likely for 9 to 11 hours, give or take. In the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. I mean, can you find 4 more radical words? Walking on the sea. Excuse me? You mean walking around the sea? No. He does one of those Pirates of the Caribbean things. He's walking under the sea. No. He's defying the physical laws that govern nature. He is walking on the sea. Which really demonstrates his power, doesn't it? Over storms. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled. And they said, it's a ghost. And they cried out for fear. Now keep in mind, here they are, they're going that direction. They're gripping wood, and they are rowing. They're looking back the direction that they came from, not really going forward. It's dark. There's no rays of light hitting the sky quite yet. The sky hasn't turned a hue of blue. It's rainy. It's windy. There's mist flying up. There's waves crashing. At some point, Jesus is walking towards them. Like, at what juncture you're Peter and you're like, there's a crash of lightning and you see something in the distance. What was that? And he kind of like, did you see that? See what? I don't know. Must have just been seafoam. Another crash of lightning. Jesus is getting closer. At some point, all of these men looking this direction, rowing, are seeing the same thing. There's someone walking on the water. But people don't walk on water. So it's not an illogic to say it's a ghost. So they're freaking out. Now, you can imagine growing up. on this body of water, there would have been all types of fun stories that the kids would tell about life on the sea. Like stories like Davy Jones's locker and, you know, things that happen mysteriously on the water. You know, fun little tales. They're convinced they're in the midst of a horror story. Not only are they dealing with a storm, now there's ghosts in the storm. Could this get any worse? But immediately, Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I. Do not be afraid." You know, in the midst of a storm, have you ever been at the beach? And there's a storm coming. The wind is really whipping. You know, you're holding on to your, you know, 10 by 10 pop-up, making sure it doesn't fly down the beach. And you're trying to get your wife's attention, you know, 20 paces in front of you to bring the chairs up. And you're yelling at the top of your lungs, and she can't hear you. Like, it's weird when you're at the beach and there's a storm, you know, you add in lightning and thunder and whatnot. And yet Jesus has no problems speaking and them hearing, which I think is a miracle in and of itself. So know that no matter how loud the storm might be and how negative the voices around you might have become, the voice of Jesus can cut through at any moment. But I love what he says. I'll be honest, I've studied this passage, I've taught this passage more than a dozen times. And in my prep this week, there was an observation made I'd never heard before. And I felt like, man, this is a wrinkle, and I love it. Look at what Jesus says in the midst of their storm. He says, "Be of good cheer, it is I. Do not be afraid." Now, the order of that is important. Note that there was an exhortation given before a revelation. We often, in the midst of our storms, want the revelation before the exhortation. We're down, we're afraid, we're filled with worry, anxiety, we're crying out to God. And what do we want? God, reveal yourself to me. Because if you'll reveal yourself to me, then I'll know that I can have joy. Then I can be of good cheer. But no, Jesus says, be of good cheer. Well, you're a ghost. No, be of good cheer. And then it is I, is actually, according to, it's eimi ego, it's I am. Jesus employs a divine title, I am that I am. But note, he says, be of good cheer. You make a decision, boys. Should the storm have power in your life to take away your joy? Well, what's joy? Joy is not to be mistaken as happiness. Now, happiness undoubtedly can come with joy. But joy is not an emotion. It's a state of being. It's actually something that is a supernatural manifestation of the Holy Spirit in your life. The fruit of the Spirit, joy is one. It's something that is produced within you supernaturally. It doesn't come from you. It can't be conjured up. Don't pray to be happy. Pray for joy. But we're told, count it all joy. What? When you face trials. Knowing that the testing of you. But what? It's count it all joy when you face trials. We want revelation before exhortation. But in the midst of our storm, what does Jesus say? Make a decision to have joy. And it's when they made that decision, what happened? Jesus revealed himself. You see, maybe you're longing for Jesus to reveal himself in your storm when the perspective should be like, you know what, I'm going to make a decision to have joy because I know that Jesus is in control. I know all things work together for the good that love him, those that are called according to your purposes. You spend Monday like Tom did with a needle in your arm being burned up by the chemotherapy. And you can cry out, I just want to see you, Jesus, but you should declare, I'm going to have joy. And Jesus will always respond with revelation. Be of good cheer. It is I. And he says, do not be afraid. Now, they have legit reasons to be afraid. Now, I love what happens next. And Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it is you, that's a terrible translation. It's since it is you. Peter's not doubting. They know it's Jesus. Since it's you, command me to come to you on the water. We become so familiar with stories that we can read through things and not really contemplate them. What is Peter thinking? Like, honestly, what within him would even present such a notion? Jesus is walking on the water. What is it that causes Peter to think, hey, that looks fun. I want to do that. Now, to his credit, he knows that there's no way he's going to get out of that boat and walk on water if Jesus doesn't command him to. Peter knows that he has to have the command of Jesus for there to be the power of Jesus for this to have a chance. Don't get out of the boat unless Jesus commands you to. Because here's the deal. Even though you might be afraid, and the boat's a dicey place, it's much better than the water. So don't get out of the boat unless Jesus commands you to get out of the boat. But again, why would Peter even think to do this or to ask? I think there are probably two reasons. According to Mark's account of the same story, which, as we noted, is Peter's recollections, there's a detail given about Jesus walking on the water that I think it explains a lot. It's a clue. According to Peter's account of the story, okay, they're rowing, Jesus is walking. They think it's a ghost. Jesus gets closer. They can talk. Be of good cheer, it is I. They recognize it's Jesus. Why would Peter say, hey, command me to get out of the boat and walk on water? Well, because Mark tells us that Jesus was walking by the boat. The phrase that's used is that Jesus was walking as if he was going to pass them by, meaning he was going to pass them by. Jesus told him, I'll meet you to the other side. Didn't let him know he was going to beat them to the other side. They had to deal with the storm. He's just going to walk on the water. I'll see you guys in a little while. I don't need the boat, obviously. I can walk on water. So Peter, the indication is like, okay, storm one. What was the key? Don't doubt Jesus. Jesus is in the boat. It's okay. His silence shouldn't be interpreted as not caring. He's with me. When I'm in a storm, you know what you need? You need Jesus with you. That's the lesson of the first storm. You need Jesus in the boat. I can speak personally, the stuff that we've gone through the last few years. I can't imagine how anyone would go through certain things without Jesus. You need Jesus in the storm. And where this story's applicational is everyone will face storms. Do you want Jesus with you or not? Now, second storm, Peter's like, okay, lesson of the first one, Jesus needs to be in the boat. Now, Jesus is not in the boat. And he doesn't seem to be interested in getting in the boat. He must know something about the boat. And he's going to keep walking that way. And first lesson, first storm, you want Jesus in the boat, but I think maybe the deeper lesson is wherever Jesus is, that's where you want to be. Jesus is in the boat, great, stay in the boat. But if Jesus is walking on water, you're safer walking on water in the storm than being in the boat because you're with Jesus. Why would Peter, hey, you called me to follow you, which I think is the other component. I think Peter took that literally. Jesus said, follow me. And he's out there walking on water. So command for me to come. So Jesus said, come. And when Peter had come down out of the boat, He walked on the water to go to Jesus. What was that like? Does he jump off the bow? Backflip. No. The boat's going up. The wind and the waves, this all happens, a storm. He gets over one leg. You know, he's touching down. Is this going to work? 2 feet. What are the other disciples thinking? When Peter lets go, it isn't sinking. And he's like, peace out, fellas. And he starts walking to Jesus. James and John, sons of thunder, are like, why didn't we think of that? Give him credit. I'm in a storm. Logic would say the boat's the right place to be. But Jesus is on the water. I just want to be with Jesus. And he said, follow me. And if that means I got to walk on water, as long as he commands me to do it, that's where I need to be. I mean, there's faith there. Let's give him credit. And he's walking on water to go to Jesus. But, verse 30, when he saw the wind and the waves, when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. He's got his eyes on Jesus. He's following Jesus. He's walking on the water. And then it starts to dawn on him what he's doing and where he is and the craziness of this situation. And then he starts looking around, and we're told he gets afraid. What am I doing out here? Has Jesus ever called you to step out and you were walking and then you started to look around and you got afraid? You know Jesus called you. You know he's there. You know that's where you're supposed to be, but you get afraid by your circumstance, by worse news. This phrase, beginning to sink, it's an odd phrase. First, if Jesus gives you the name Rock, walking on water, probably, but even as the Rock, I don't know if you've ever tried to walk on water and failed. You don't begin to sink. You sink real fast. Like it's, what was this? He's beginning to sink. He hasn't sunk all the way. He's looking down and his feet disappear. But that's not good. And he's looking around some more and the water's getting up to his calves. Like that's weird. He's beginning to sink. But he does something wise. He prays, Lord, save me. It's one of the smallest prayers in the Bible, but it's pretty effective. He doesn't use any great terminology, great words of theology. It's not very long, just a couple words. But you know why Jesus responded? Because he meant it. Your prayers don't have to be long to be effective. They don't have to be wordy for God to hear them. He's beginning to sink. If he's already sunk, he can't cry out. He could try, as long as we'll fill with water. But he senses that he's beginning to sink, and he's wise at the beginning to cry out for the Lord to save him. You know, I think one of the mistakes that we make in storms is that we know we're sinking. We're trying. We're doing our best. But we know we're beginning to sink. We're walking on water, and we had our eyes on Jesus, and there's wind and there's waves, but we've stepped out, and but we're beginning to get distracted, and things are beginning to happen, and we sense it. We're beginning. There's the beginning of something that will end in my destruction. It's starting. I feel it. The mistake we make is that we don't acknowledge it then. Hey, you're walking on water. What do you have to apologize for? See, Peter is beginning to sink, and he's wise enough to cry out, Lord, save me. Because he knows that if Jesus doesn't intervene, he's going under. Are you beginning to sink? Shoot, some of you might be, dude, I'm 20 feet under the water right now, man. And what does Jesus do? Immediately, Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him. And he said to him, Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. Those who were in the boat came and worshiped Jesus, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. Oh, you of little faith. It's actually one word in the Greek. It's a noun. Jesus is giving him now a second nickname. Little Faither. He's gone from Peter to Little Faither. Irony, he's the only one out of the boat. Why did you doubt? Why did you doubt? What did Peter doubt? Did he doubt Jesus? No, I don't think so. He would have never gotten out of the boat. Did he doubt that he would be saved or not? I don't think so. Like, what did Peter doubt? Peter doubted that he could walk on water. Even though Jesus was with him, and even though Jesus called him, even though Jesus was in control, what did Peter doubt? That God could really do this in him and demonstrate this power through him. You know, so often we, and listen, I'm not the Dr. Phil / Oprah theology of self-help. You don't need to be a better you. You need to be a new creation in Christ Jesus. And yet sometimes we doubt whether or not we can be that new creation in Christ Jesus. And storms bring us to that edge, don't they? And Jesus is like, you can do it. If I command you to, even if it defies everything, you can do this. Peter would have a lot of faith. Peter would begin to sink in multiple seasons of life. And yet there's this constant exhortation. When Peter writes about trial and tribulation, what's he saying? He's saying, hey, if you have the power of God, the storm has no power over you. Now, I want to give you one more thought. Flip very quickly to John's gospel, John chapter 6. I'm going to read this story very quickly. Therefore, when Jesus perceived, verse 15, that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he departed again to the mountain by himself alone. Now, when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into the boat, went over the sea towards Capernaum. It was already dark. Jesus had not come to them. The sea rose because the great wind was blowing. And when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near the boat. They were afraid. And he said to them, it is I, do not be afraid. Then they willingly received him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at land where they were going. Now, I have a thought. So often when we read a story like this that we're super familiar with, we naturally assume the way the story plays out by the perception and the way it's been presented all the times that we've heard it. I had an idea, a thought, that's a totally different way of reading this. So much so that Jessica was like, I think you should call David Guzik before you share this. I said, I think you're right. Because often if it's new, it's not true. I had a conversation with David yesterday. And he was like, I have never thought about that. But I don't think the text excludes that way of reading it. What do we know about the story? They're in the boat. They're going across the sea. They're at the halfway point. Jesus comes down, is going to pass them by. At which point, Peter gets out of the boat and he's following Jesus walking on the water. Then the whole scene happens. He sinks. Jesus picks him up. They get in the boat. And then John says, boom, they're on dry land. Which means that according to John, and this the way that you would hear it, this is like a horizontal teleportation. Like instantly, 3.5 miles, they've crossed the sea. Now, there's two assumptions that are made in that reading. First assumption is that John is describing for us a miracle and is not just making an observation. We think immediately the boat was at the land where they were going in the sense that it was at the 3.5 mile mark, and that would be obviously a miracle for it to be immediately there. Second assumption, though, because John could just be making an observation. Second assumption is how long Peter was walking on the water. The Bible doesn't tell us. The Bible makes no mention how long Peter was walking on the water. We're told that he's walking on the water and he's following Jesus. Jesus is going to land and I'm following him. How long did he walk before he started to sink? How far did he go as he was starting to sink? How far did the pier go following Jesus? Presumably, boat's still going with them. Could it be Peter is sinking and he doesn't know that they're already at the shore and that there's dry land like 7 or 8 inches under him? He's beginning to sink and Jesus is like, bud. And they get into the boat and they're at the shore. Why? Because they were already at the shore. That this isn't a miracle of teleportation, but that Peter was following Jesus for a few miles. And then he begins to sink because he gets distracted. They can't see where they are. They're disoriented. And they begin to worship him because, it's the hilarity of the moment for Peter, because he's like, I wasn't going to drown at all. I'm sinking in 3 feet of water. And Jesus is like, little faither, you're at the shore. Why did you doubt you got here? There's nothing in the text that says that that isn't possible. Now, that's not the traditional way of looking at it, understood. But here would be my application. Not to bring it up for novelty's sake. So often, do you know when we start to sink? In our storm. Is it at the beginning of the storm? No, not typically. Is it in the middle part? We might have doubts, but no. We're following Jesus. I have found that oftentimes in my own life, when I reach that moment where I get my eyes off of Jesus and I start to get distracted, it's because the storm just seems to have gone on forever. And it's at this point I start to wonder, is there dry land? Does the storm end? How big is this body of water? It's at the end of the storm that I typically take my eyes off of Jesus and I begin to doubt and my faith begins to crack and I begin to cry out, Lord, save me. And the Lord is faithful to save me and he'll pick me up and he'll put me in the boat. But you know what I often realize? I was at the end. I was in 3 feet of water. I got worried about 3 feet of water. That the same Jesus that meets us in the storm is there to carry us through the end of the storm. To the end. Don't give up at the end. Keep your eye on Jesus. I think Jesus absolutely intended for him and Peter to walk up onto the shore, the boat to follow in. Don't don't give up at the end. And if you do, and you're beginning to sink, cry out to Jesus. Because, you know, I can still drown in 3 feet of water. So, Father, Lord, thank you for your word.